There are many memorable scenes in the 1959 movie classic Ben-Hur, winner of 11 Academy Awards. The mother and sister of Judah Ben-Hur in the leper colony and their subsequent healing. The prisoners rowing on the Roman ship at various speeds as the Roman soldier is beating on the drum, and he then might increase the speed and they've got to row accordingly. And who can forget the exciting chariot race in the movie? But the movie climaxes with a scene appropriate to this time of the year, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Christ is nailed to the cross. That heavy object is dropped into a hole in the ground at Golgotha. Slowly, drops of his blood begin to fall to the ground, creating a puddle at the base of the cross. A storm approaches, and lightning and thundering occur as well, as the raindrops start falling, mingling with the blood. More and more rain, more and more blood, until puddles begin to trickle down the hillside. The camera pans back slowly, following the trickling of the water and blood until it becomes a flowing stream. You are left in your imagination and in your mind's eye as you see that blood spreading from stream to stream, river to river, ocean to ocean, until it touches every shore, symbolizing the fact that his blood was spilled for the whole world. And that happened. That happened 1989 years ago. Why? As the allegory in Ezekiel 16 says, that you and I might have life. The scripture says, and when I passed by you, saw you struggling, dying in your own blood, I said to you in your blood, live. Yes, I said to you in your blood, live. This is what God desires. This is what Christ desires for you, for me, for the entire world. But at what price? At what price? A few weeks ago, I started reading this account. We were dealing with Passover through the eyes of the Father. I want to begin here the sermon with it and recount what was stated before and going forward to conclusion of what the illustration states. It's a warm spring day, and Bob, who works for the railroad, has just begun his work day. Bob is a switchman for the railroad, and his job site is located at the large river just outside of town. Bob's job is to raise and lower the railroad track when necessary to allow the ships to pass down the river. On this warm spring day, Bob has allowed his young son, Tim, to come to work with him. It is getting along about lunchtime, so Bob and Tim go out onto a large, massive superstructure to eat their lunch in the sunshine. Just as they begin to eat, Bob hears the whistle of the train in the distance. Bob looks at his watch and tells Tim that must be the Limited, full of passengers, heading into the city. Bob instructs Tim to stay right where he is and finish his lunch, as he would be right across the river. Before lowering the tracks, Bob checked just one more time for Tim, finding that he is not in his place. Frantically searching, looking back and forth across the structure, Bob finally looks down into the gearbox below. There lies his little son, intertwined in the gears. Bob has a decision to make. The train is speeding on its way, and there is no time left. At the very last moment, Bob pushes the lever that starts the bridge down, crushing the young boy, but allowing many lives of those on the train to live. As the train passes over the bridge, Bob can see through the windows of the train. The people are eating and talking to each other as if nothing has happened. Children are running up and down, playing, unconcerned as to anything in the outside world. Bob presses his face against the glass in the control room and he cries in a loud voice, "Don't you care? Don't you care? Don't you care that I gave my only son for you?" I wonder if God feels the same way about our lack of concern over his giving his only son for us, that we might have life. With that in mind, let's begin to grasp the awesomeness of what has been done for us, to personalize it for me, for me. We start in Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. These are instructions regarding the Passover, and there is an important principle that will begin to emerge from this, a principle of substitution. Understanding this principle, we begin to understand the enormity of what has been done for us, for me, for me. Exodus chapter 12, beginning with verse 3, "Speak to all of the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household." As I mentioned earlier in the year, the Passover week this year coincides with the Passover week of 31 AD, as Christ was crucified on the Wednesday, and that will occur this coming Wednesday, 1989 years ago. The 10th day then in which this lamb was set apart would have been yesterday. And he most likely entered into the temple. As he looked inside of the temple, and all things were set in order at that point. Verse 4, "And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons, according to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb." The first Passover was at home Passover. You don't find the instructions about having an in-home Passover after this. The instructions given in Deuteronomy 16, that you are now to go to the place in which God's name resides. But here, this first one, this very important one, they were at home. They were at home. And they might be able to join with a neighbor next to them. Verse 5, "Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight." Verse 22, "You shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in blood that is in the basin, strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning." Now they had a specific reason in mind for doing this, but there could very well have been symbolism at this point. In the book, Christ in the Passover by C.L. and Moshe Rosen, Messianic Jews, they comment on this verse. The basin mentioned in Exodus 12, 22 was not a container in the sense we use the word basin today. The word is the Hebrew sap, meaning the threshold or ditch which was dug just in front of the doorways of the houses to avoid flooding. The people placed a container in the ditch to prevent seepage. The Israelites killed their Passover lambs right by the doors where they were about to sprinkle the blood, and the blood of the slaughter automatically ran into the depression, the basin at the threshold. When they painted the blood on with the hyssop brush, they first touched the lintel, the top horizontal part of the door frame, then each side post vertical sides. Thus the door was sealed on all four sides with the blood of the lamb. because the blood was already on the bottom. And they conclude their paragraph with Arthur Pink, a late Arthur Pink, prolific writer, sees this as a picture of the suffering Messiah himself. Blood above, where the thorns pierced his brow. Blood on the sides, for his nails, for his nail-pierced hands. And blood below, from the nails that pierced his feet. Possibility. Possibility. But why was this done? Why? Verse 23. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you. In verse 29, it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. Without the blood, their firstborn would die, because the death angel passed through Egypt killing the firstborn. When that happened, think about the great cry in Egypt of those without the blood. As this death angel moves, quite similar to coronavirus, this death angel moves through the land. Those that did not have the blood, what a cry emerged from that house. For they were not under the blood, and it became a night of horror. But for those under the blood, it was a night of thanksgiving, because their firstborn was exempted from death. The firstborn. It's a type of all mankind. The firstborn. It is a type of me. And I can say that personally because I am a firstborn, the only born of my mother. And what we're beginning to learn about is this principle of substitution. The lamb died in place of the firstborn. Now, instructions are given later on in chapter 12 that it is only to be those who are circumcised that are to partake of it. Circumcision in the New Testament would be baptism. So this is for baptized members. But let's proceed to the New Testament. Matthew chapter 26. As Christ institutes a new ceremony to commemorate his death. For us to observe on an annual basis, not every week, not every day, not every month or quarterly, annual basis. Matthew 26, verse 26 to 28. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it, gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them saying, drink from it all of you, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. Sin, the breaking of the law of God. Sin, all of us are guilty of committing. I am guilty of committing. Sin, the wages of which is death. That sword of Damocles hanging over my head. These new elements are equivalent to the lamb and the blood in Exodus, for the same purpose, that I might be exempted from death, that I might have life. Notice how. Go over to the next chapter, Matthew 27. Matthew 27, verse 15 to 26. Matthew 27, verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wish. His release would be celebrated because it reminded the Jews of the Passover in Egypt. And not only the Passover in Egypt, but being liberated as prisoners in Egypt. So they were able now to use this as a object lesson to them to remember the servitude, the slavery of Egypt when the governor released the prisoner. Verse 16, and at that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. My margin and a number of the margins of King James, New King James, use the Nestle United and says that this is Jesus Barabbas. Notorious prisoner called Jesus Barabbas. We'll deal with the Jesus part of it shortly. But what's interesting is this name, Barabbas. Compound. The first part of it, bar, B-A-R, it means son or son of. Remember when Christ referred to Peter, says Simon Barjona? That means Simon, son of Jonah. And here Barabbas, son of whom? Abbas, son of the father, son of the father. The man was a murderer. The man was an insurrectionist. As you read it in the parallel accounts, he's probably the worst of the worst. Verse 17, therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas, or using the margin of verse 16, Jesus, who is called Barabbas, or Jesus, who is called Christ? Pilate is using this as an opportunity to release Christ because he knows he is innocent. And certainly they would not ask for Barabbas. If it is a choice between a Mother Teresa and an Adolf Hitler, and you can release one or the other, whom do you think people would call for? Obviously, Mother Teresa. Nobody's going to call for Hitler. Verse 18, for he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. Who is the destroyer? Who is the ultimate force behind all of this? He has been prophesied from the time of the Garden of Eden to bruise the heel of the seed. Satan lurks. And there is no doubt, even with what is going on now, either whether it culminates in the coming of Christ, the return of Jesus Christ, or just gives us a picture. It's almost like he is covering the whole world for destroying mankind. He is the destroyer. But they're asking to destroy Christ. Verse 21, the governor answered and said to them, which of the two do you want me to release to you? They said, Barabbas, Jesus, who was called Barabbas. Pilate said to them, what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ? They all said to him, let him be crucified. The governor said, why? What evil has he done? But they cried out all the more, saying, let him be crucified. When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water, washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. Too many, even in the realm of Christianity, too many of us as those professing Christians are like Pilate and like to wash our hands and say we're innocent of his death. We're innocent of his death. I have referred to Book of Lamentations that I decided 20 years ago I didn't want to ever go through the book of Lamentations again. It's just too graphic a description of what happens in great tribulation. You get a foretaste of what we're going through now. But when I went through the book of Lamentations, I concluded with a video. Video is a French production entitled Night and Fog. It has the English byline at the bottom, and it helps you as you read it in English. You don't see the graphic pictures that are brought out on the video itself. But after the SS guards were taken into captivity, taken to prison of Hitler's regime, they are brought before the judicial system. And they are asked the question, who is responsible? And one by one, they would say, I am not responsible. I am not responsible. And consequently, the movie, the video leaves you with the question, well, who is? Who is? Who killed Jesus Christ? Pilate? Yes. The soldiers? Yes. The Jewish leaders? Caiaphas? Annas? Chief priests? Sanhedrin? Yes. But understanding the scope of his sacrifice, we all killed Jesus Christ. We all crucified him. We all sin. I crucified Jesus Christ. When I go through baptismal counseling, to just emphasize the importance of this topic when we deal with repentance. We deal with the book of Acts when the Jews are observing Feast of Pentecost. A miracle has occurred as they are speaking in tongues and languages of those that are all around. And Peter steps forward because a number of them think that, hey, you're drunk. Peter says, no, we're not drunk. It's only 9th hour of the morning. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning. We're not drunk. But what has happened to us is because of Jesus Christ. There's a prophecy in Joel that talks about Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ came to this earth. Jesus Christ lived. Jesus Christ did miracles. Jesus Christ did this, that, and the other. And he concludes by saying, therefore, let all know assuredly that God has made that same Jesus whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ. It says when they heard this, they were pricked, cut to the heart. They were cut. Now, as I go through this, I try to put them in this perspective of these individuals that Peter is preaching to. Some of them probably were not there 7 weeks earlier when Christ was crucified to make a pilgrimage feast from Europe every 3 times in a year. That's kind of difficult, especially for this middle one, Feast of Pentecost. It could take several weeks even to get to Jerusalem and then several weeks to get back home. So some of them probably weren't even there, but they were cut to the heart. Why? Because they understood personally. They understood they were responsible, individually responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. As I explain the point, and I don't necessarily like use hypothetical situations, suppose, even with this virus we have going around now, suppose this virus wipes out all human beings on the face of this earth, except for one. As I'm trying to get across, because normally I'll get a response, who killed Jesus Christ? They say, well, the Jews did. And they say, well, the Roman soldiers did. Try to get across this one point. All human beings are wiped off the face of the earth, except for you. And in this supposition, Christ had not come 2,000 years ago. Would Christ leave his throne, come down to die for you? See what we're getting at here. To understand what I have done, I'm responsible. I am responsible for his death. I crucified Jesus Christ. And I can't wash my hands of it. Verse 25, and all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Yes, his blood was on the Jews. His blood was on the firstborn. His blood is on me. Then he released Barabbas to them. And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Barabbas was given his freedom, given his life. He went home, possibly had a home-cooked meal, slept in his own bed, enjoyed his freedom. We don't know what happened to him. Even though the movie that came out some 60 years ago, starring Anthony Quinn, I believe it was, portrays its ideas, saying that he probably ended up repenting and becoming a disciple of Jesus Christ. I don't know. We don't know what happened to him. But one thing is certain. If I understand the principle of substitution, I am Barabbas. I am Barabbas. Jesus, the innocent, died for me, the guilty. It took the death of the Son of God for me, the Son of the Father, to have life. Christ was flogged, scourged by a man called a lictor, Roman soldier. The movie, The Passion of the Christ, gives a very, very graphic portrayal of that event. It's hard to imagine as Mary, as they in the movie, as Mary is hearing the thuds and seeing the blood. She was just completely numb. I mean, the brain just apparently atrophied inside of her, according to the movie. We don't know what actually happened, but it was a very difficult experience, no doubt. Then he is crucified as he is led to Golgotha. Let's go to John 19. John 19, after the scourging, he now goes to Golgotha, where he will die. John 19, beginning with verse 28, it says, after this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, he said, I thirst. We commented in the Bible study, this was the fifth saying of Jesus Christ on the cross. Verse 29, now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with the sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it to his mouth. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. The sixth saying of Jesus Christ. And Luke 23 ends up with the seventh saying, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Then, bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. Verse 31, therefore, because it was the preparation day, that Tuesday, preparation day for the Sabbath that is coming on the week Wednesday evening, it would be this coming Wednesday, evening, the evening portion of Wednesday after Tuesday. We find now the Passover is going to be observed Tuesday night, then Wednesday night, night to be much observed. It's a holy day. Preparation day that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, a holy day. The Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away, as mentioned in the Bible study. Breaking of the legs hastened the death process. Crucifixion was a lingering form of death. They did not die before a day and a half. That's why it was intended to go on and on for a day and a half. Christ is only on the cross for some 6 hours. Verse 32, then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other, who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. One of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. As we have mentioned, the order of this is probably out of whack. Tie in here Matthew 27, verses 46 to 50 in the 20th century New Testament. In the 20th century New Testament, as he is given the sour wine, they say that he said, crying out, wondering if he is crying out to Elijah. But then verse 49 here of Matthew 27 in the 20th century New Testament, it says, but the rest said, wait, let us see if Elijah is coming to save him. However, another man took a spear and pierced his side, and water and blood flowed from it. But Jesus, uttering another loud cry, gave up his spirit. Move over to John 20 now, in verse 24. Christ dies, Christ is resurrected. He appears to his disciples. John 20, 24. Now Thomas, called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said to him, we have seen the Lord. So he said to them, unless I see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. It's just the crucifixion itself, the nails that they use. Put my finger into his hand where the print of the nails were. Use your finger. See the size of the nail. But then he says, put my hand into his side. Now he could have just pierced, the soldier could have just pierced the side. It says blood and water came out, started flowing out. Just putting his finger or hand into the side. Just ball up a fist. It gives possibly an indication of what the Roman soldier did. Not only did he stick the sword or the spear into the side, he apparently twisted that sword around. Blood and water poured out. Verse 26, after 8 days, confirmation. His disciples were again inside and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors being shut, stood in the midst and said, peace to you. Then he said to Thomas, reach your finger here. Look at my hands. And reach your hand here and put it into my side. Somewhat corroborating that there's possibly a hole that was in the side of Jesus Christ. Think about the Roman soldier. Soldiers in the Roman army would serve for 20 years. And they would go all around the Roman Empire, quelling rebellions, keeping the peace. And normally after they served their 20 years, they would most likely retire in an area where they might be serving. Very few Romans would retire in Jerusalem or Israel. This is a Roman soldier. He has killed people before. He probably killed people after. This is just another notch on his spear. Let us go through hypothesis again. Suppose then, after he has served his stint, he returns to Rome, because quite a few of them would go back home to Rome and they would run for the Senate. And he served in the Senate. And he now lives out of the rest of his life and he dies. He then comes up several millennia later, second resurrection, billions coming up out of the grave all around the world, billions, including the Roman soldier. And there is a voice that now is heard all over the earth, the voice of Ezekiel, as Ezekiel 37 indicates. As he now is able to preach to the entire world. The reason you are here is because it has been prophesied Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ came to this earth. Jesus Christ lived. Jesus Christ died. Therefore, let all the earth know assuredly that God has made that same Jesus Lord, Master, High Priest, King. In the supposition, you can imagine the Christians who are probably saying to each other, "Praise the Lord, I thought this was supposed to be heaven. This isn't heaven. Who is this Jesus?" But the majority of them, who is this Jesus? And possibly as well, the Roman soldier, who is this Jesus? In the supposition, let us suppose then that each area of the world has an opportunity to go to Jerusalem to meet Jesus Christ in person. The Roman soldier is in this delegation. They come over to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is such a beautiful place. I was going through 2 Chronicles, and it describes this week. It describes this temple that Solomon built and the city that Solomon built in Jerusalem, people coming from all around the world, and they're looking at this great, beautiful city. And not only that, the temple is so beautiful, even the servants that Solomon had, and they ate off of gold plates and gold silverware, if you will, goldware. But the primary thing that is brought out is that opportunity to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Here we are in the supposition. This Roman delegation gets this opportunity to go to Jerusalem. And you look up on the hill, and here is the temple. And they ascend up to the temple as the doors open. And the angel now blows the trumpet, introducing delegation number 10 from Rome. And there is this long red carpet. At the other end is a throne upon which Christ is sitting. Lining both sides of the red carpet, glorified beings clapping, cheering for this group that has come. You've been instructed, as you go down to meet Jesus Christ in person, first thing you do, you get 10 feet away, you drop to one knee because he is a king. They start walking down the red carpet. And as they walk, beads of perspiration starts forming on this Roman soldier's head as he's wondering, oh, who is this man? His heart races even faster. Who is this man? They get 30 feet, 20 feet, 10 feet. All in his delegation go down on one knee, but him. There's this recognition. Jerusalem, years ago, a man was crucified. This is that man. I am the one with the spear. I am the one that stuck that spear into his side. I am the one with disdain twisted that spear around the side of Jesus Christ. I would say, you want an example of being cut to the heart, as Acts 2 says? Coming to that point of recognition, he would be. But understanding the principle of substitution, I am the Roman soldier. I am the one with the spear. I am the one that stuck it in the side of Jesus Christ. I am the one that twisted it around in Jesus Christ. You understand the magnitude of what we're dealing with here? There's the old Negro spiritual. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? It's not they who crucified him. I did. I am the firstborn in Egypt. I am Barabbas. I am the lictor. I am the Roman soldier. I crucified Jesus Christ. Go to Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, beginning with verse 1. Ephesians chapter 2, beginning with verse 1. It says, "And you he made alive, who were dead because of sin. I was on death row, like the firstborn in Egypt. I was on death row, like Barabbas. I was struggling in my own blood," as Ezekiel 16 says, "in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit which now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves." And you see, this is the personal side, especially of Passover. It's not just so much the group dynamic. This is between you and me, Lord. As I go back in my past, I think of one Passover at home for me. I wasn't able to attend. I've been at Passovers over 50 years, and I wasn't able to attend. But there is something about taking it by yourself. It's you and me, God. It's you and me. "Among whom we all once conducted ourselves in the lust of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as others." Former President of the United States referred to Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as the axis of evil. The real axis of evil is me, myself, and I. That's the real axis of evil. Sin isn't just out there. Sin just isn't in my neighbors or my coworkers. Sin is in here. The heart is deceitful above all things, desperately wicked, desperately sick. There is wrath inside. There is animosity inside. Carnal mind is enmity against God. It's not subject to the law of God. It doesn't want to be. There is a part of the nature of Satan in me. And that puts us all under the wrath of God due to sin. But, verse 4, "but God." But God, I am the firstborn. But God, I am Barabbas. But God, I am the lictor. But God, I am the Roman soldier. But God, I am the one struggling in my own blood. But God, who is rich in mercy because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead, made us alive with Christ. By grace, you have been saved. It is important to understand the gravity of what I've done. Then I can understand the greatness of the love of God and begin to understand why it is so important to carry on from the Bible study, cancel the debts of others. Go to 1 Corinthians 11. This has been brought out last week. Mr. Franks mentions it in a court. We bring it up. I bring it up again. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is dealing with verses 27 to 29. 1 Corinthians 11, "Therefore, whoever eats this bread and drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord." Obviously, the focus is on taking it in an unworthy manner. We can go into a multitude of ways in which that can be done. But two things I bring out. One, they don't understand the greatness of the love of God. They don't understand the greatness of the love of God. And two, They don't understand the greatness of God's mercy and forgiveness. They don't understand the greatness of his mercy and forgiveness. And so Paul continues. He says, let a man examine himself. I don't examine my wife. I don't examine my husband. I don't examine my parents. I examine me. And so let him eat of the bread, drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning or understanding the Lord's body. Just explore that just a little bit here. Examine or understand the greatness of his love. Go to 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4, verses 7 to 11. 1 John chapter 4, verses 7 to 11. John says, beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. Everyone who loves is born of God, is Bar-Abba, son of the Father, and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. In this, the love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent his only begotten Son into the world, that he might live, we might live, I might live through him. And this is love, that not that we loved God, but that he loved us, sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. God so loved the world. God loved Pharaoh. God loved the firstborn. God loved Barabbas. God loved the Roman soldier. God loved Hitler. God loved Mother Teresa. And we look at animosities that we have in our countries today, in which we can hate certain political leaders. God loved Barack Obama. God loves Donald Trump. He loved me. And he says to me, go, do likewise, and show that love. And then the second part of understanding the greatness of his forgiveness, Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. Matthew 18, the whole account, and I'm not going to go through the whole account, you're familiar with it, verses 21 to 35. Verse 21, it says, then Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times. Jews forgave three times based on what is stated at the beginning of the book of Amos, Amos 1 and 2. There's a parallel, somewhat of a parallel scripture of this in Luke chapter 17, which says you forgive seven times in a day. Christ verse 22 says, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. No way he is going to sin against you 490 times. Christ wants us to understand the enormity of our sin against God. I am the firstborn. I am Barabbas. I am the Roman soldier. Compared to what I have done to God, what others have done to me is minor by comparison. Verse 23, therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Not going through all the details of calculating all of this. When we look at the cost of gold, of the rate of gold right now, we're talking about almost $14 to $15 billion U.S. $14 to $15 billion. Set an arbitrary salary, like a U.S. salary of $50,000 a year. You would have to work nearly 300,000 years, 300,000 years to pay off that debt. Is it possible? But as he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold, and his wife and his children and all that he had, that payment may be made. The servant therefore fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. The master of the servant was moved with compassion, which is usually used in the gospel accounts of the love of Jesus Christ. Released him, forgave him the debt, canceling the debt. But that servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. Laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, pay me what you owe me. So his fellow servants fell down and at his feet, begged him, saying, have patience with me and I will pay you all. But he would not. So he went and threw him into prison till he paid it all. 14, 15 billion dollars. He found someone who owed him 100 denarii, 3 months' wages, something like $12,000. $12,000. At least Peter is willing to forgive 7 times. This servant wasn't even willing to forgive once. Why? He failed to realize the enormity of the debt he had just been forgiven. He failed to understand what had been owed God by what he had done. By comparison, we fail to recognize the enormity of our sin against God when we don't forgive. Yet the petty little things that others do to us are so great, aren't they? $12,000 ain't chump change. It's a lot. But we don't see how great the debt it is that we owe God. But you notice over in verse 28, it says he went out. When we go from God's presence, we forget. We forget him. We forget his benefits. We forget his love. We forget his mercy. Paul said in Galatians chapter 2, 20 to 21 in the Living Bible, I am not one of those who treats Christ's death as meaningless. We do not grasp the love of God with an unforgiving spirit. And we could be knocking on the door of committing an unpardonable sin. The lesson is clear. We can't forgive others until we comprehend the forgiveness we've experienced. And by failing to forgive, we cut ourselves off from God, and we don't mirror God. Too often, we could be mirroring Satan. I'm not going to read the rest of this, but remember Judas? I'm sure maybe from time to time, we might have thought about it. Why did he do what he did? Why did he betray Jesus Christ? Oh, I never would do such a thing as that, really? Really? He had been around Christ for 3.5 years. He was with him even the night of the Passover, just like we will be Tuesday night. What got into Judas? Disillusionment? Impatience? Sense of rejection? Weakness? Regardless, if we do not discern the Lord's body, if we don't understand Jesus Christ, we could be walking in the same steps as Judas. Because it's now my turn. I understand I am the firstborn in Egypt. I understand that I am Barabbas. I understand that I am the Roman soldier. I understand that I am forgiven. Now I must not become Judas Iscariot. Do I discern that Lord's body and come to the Passover with a thankful attitude at the magnitude of the forgiveness I've been given? And he expects me to be different when I leave. As I wrap this up, I want to go back in history of this country, the period of the Civil War. Very lengthy story. It's about a soldier His name was William Scott. And it says William Scott fell as a soldier. He was stationed to keep watch and he fell asleep. It was a second straight evening in which he had volunteered to replace a sick comrade at this post. He was found by his relief to be sound asleep. He was tried that day, found guilty, sentenced to be shot the following day. While justice was being served, his fellow soldiers of Company C thought mercy was in order. They hastily began their series of panicked appeals. Shortly, they gained a hearing with Abraham Lincoln. Upon hearing the circumstances of the case and of the character of the convicted soldier, Lincoln agreed to visit the soldier. William Scott spoke later of this encounter. Quote, "The president was the kindest man I'd ever seen. I knew him at once by a Lincoln medal I had long worn. I was scared at first, for I had never been talked with by a great man. But Mr. Lincoln was so easy with me, so gentle, that I soon forgot my fright. He asked me all about the people at home, the neighbors, the farm, and where I went to school, and who my schoolmates were." Scott continues by telling that Lincoln spoke with him about his mother in great detail. The condemned soldier wanted only to request that he not be executed by his own regiment. Lincoln never allowed this request. Instead, Lincoln told him he was not going to be shot. But Lincoln then explained to him that he had gone to a great deal of trouble on Scott's account and asked him how he was going to pay the bill for Lincoln's trouble. The grateful soldier tried to figure out how the maximum sum could be raised to pay Lincoln for his trouble. He could borrow from his comrades, mortgage the farm back home, give him his pay, and such things as this. Lincoln told him that would not be nearly enough. Scott countered with the assurance that he would do all he could to repay his benefactor. Lincoln put his hand on the soldier's shoulder, and continued, "My boy, my bill is a very large one. Your friends cannot pay it, nor your bounty, nor the farm, nor all your comrades. There is only one man in all the world who can pay it, and his name is William Scott. If from this day William Scott does his duty, so that if I was there when he comes to die, he can look me in the face as he does now and say, I have kept my promise. I have done my duty as a soldier. Then my debt will be paid. Will you make that promise and try to keep it?" William Scott promised Lincoln that he would indeed try to repay the debt in such manner. And so he lived his life as a valiant soldier, fighting with resolve and courage. On April 15, 1862, while fighting the Confederates at Yorktown, he proved himself once more. After crossing the Warwick River, the Union troops found themselves overwhelmed by the firepower of the Confederates. They hastened a retreat across the river. Many were killed and wounded. Scott returned several times and carried wounded across the river on his back. The final wounded man was being carried on the back of William Scott. The fire of the rebels was now focused on him. He staggered with his load to the shore and was dragged to safety by his company. His comrades describe him as being shot to pieces with blood pouring from his open wounds. He was soon to die. He lasted through the night, called his friends to his side. Toward morning, he called them. With a cheerful countenance, he told them that he had fought his final battle and was ready to die. "I have tried to do the right thing," I am almost certain you will all say that. If any of you ever have the chance, I wish you would tell President Lincoln that I have never forgotten the kind words he said to me at the Chain Bridge, that I've tried to be a good soldier and true to the flag, that I should have paid my whole debt to him if I had lived, but that now, when I know that I am dying, I think of his kind face and thank him again because he gave me the chance to fall like a soldier in battle, not like a coward by the hands of my comrades. We come to Passover 2020 to thank a God for the mercy that he has given. And who knows? Obviously, one of the things that registers in the back of our minds with coronavirus, we can see the infestation. The death total is only up to 60,000. It may even be more. We don't know about the reporting, how far it will expand around the world, how detailed, how many will die. One thing is in the back of the mind: if I get it, will I die? I don't know. That's up to God. But I do know, even as the Apostle Paul says, we are all going to come to a point even of a final Passover because our departure is near. Can we say, I fought the fight. I fought a good fight. I finished the race so I can stand and look Jesus Christ in the eye and say, because of the forgiveness I've been given, I followed in your footsteps. As true soldiers of Christ, our debt has been forgiven because of the love of God. He now expects us to go out and shine the light of his love to a world. To summarize 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9, he died that I might live. Now I must die that he will live his life through me. Do I begin to grasp the magnitude of what has been done? The enormity of the debt that has been forgiven? I should have no problem canceling the debt of others. I should have no problem. What forgiveness is not recovered, what forgiveness is, and the reason why. Because of how great this debt is. I am going to conclude, if we are able to get this to work, with a song. Song by Ray Bolts, entitled Watch the Lamb. This song is not to be part of the message that is being recorded. It's a lengthy song. It's over 7 minutes in length. It's about a man with his two sons going to Jerusalem to sacrifice a lamb, the Passover lamb, just like we will be doing as we commemorate that Passover sacrificial lamb this coming Tuesday evening. After seeing the events of the crucifixion of Jesus, it so impacted the man that he was changed when he left Jerusalem. What about us? We did not see what happened nearly 2,000 years ago. We did not experience the events firsthand. But if we understand what happened 1989 years ago, then we will sit down at the Passover this coming Tuesday evening, understand the seriousness of the ceremony, understand the enormity of what has been done for me, understand the enormity of the forgiveness I've received, and I will not leave that ceremony the same. So watch the Lamb and follow his example of love, of mercy, and forgiveness.